Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Front Three podcast. Now, no, Lawrence McKenna is not great at doing impressions. I mean, he is, but he can't do mine. I am Christian Hennage. I'm obviously joined by the aforementioned Lawrence and also Dave O'Brien. Dave, you are flying around Europe, you little jet setter. Tell us more.
Oh, well, I'm in Leipzig and it's absolutely freezing. Like, you know when you say it's cold and you think it's cold, like I've got to wear an extra like pair of gloves or I've got to wear a coat. This is like next level cold. Went to go and get some food a second ago, right? Minus 10. It's snowing, it's everything. It's, you know, blowing a gale and all sorts. Very, very cold.
You are northern as well, so it's cold is cold.
Yeah, cold is cold. Been to Scotland and that was cold, but this is another level of cold.
Well, it certainly wasn't cold in Manchester this weekend. Now, Dave, obviously, we need to keep you objective on this one, but Man City to Tottenham 2. Did you have any striking thoughts of the game just as a result and how it impacts the rest of the title race?
I think it's obviously an interesting. I kind of expected City to kind of pull it out of the bag in a way. You know, obviously Guardiola did it previously against Arsenal where he completely turned the game on its head after half time, but it was kind of the other way around, wasn't it? Obviously City taking that early goal. Bit of a mistake from Lloris, but you've got to kind of expect that from top goalkeepers that they will eventually have a little bit of an error once in a while. Obviously Kevin De Bruyne are gambling on that making it, but it's quite interesting for the Premier League and where it takes City, Tottenham. It's so fascinating that top six right now, and I think that's the most crazy thing. Obviously Liverpool losing, City and Tottenham drawing, Manchester United drawing, and then Arsenal and Chelsea sort of pulling away. But I think it's the overall impression that Guardiola is still here and still very much tactically very, very astute in what he's doing, so we can't write him off yet.
He looked really angry, I thought, at a lot of points. Even his interview with the BBC, he talked about them being a prestigious outlet and how they shouldn't be asking certain questions, or questioned the fact even that they were asking about the referee as their first question.
He's right. The BBC aren't bad. The BBC aren't doing a great job right now, and they're not showing everyone else how to do it. They're going down Sky level and everyone else's levels, and they need to buck up their ideas because they're letting everyone down who's in the public. And they're letting down people by employing certain journalists and employing certain pundits who are just awful.
There we go. An explosive opinion jettisoned in there, like a wildly run, if you will. Dave, I'm curious though, Hugo Lloris, as a goalkeeper, world class, we talk about these tags that we want to throw on players. This is a pair of mistakes, I would argue. You look at the Sané goal, he should really be making a better decision there, either clearing it completely or whatever. The second, again, I would consider a fairly routine situation for a goalkeeper. Is it something that Pochettino should be worried about? Is it something that might stop Lloris getting that move to that from time to time during his Spurs career?
No, absolutely not. I think in terms of goalkeeping, he's best in the Premier League. I think Lloris ahead of the level reaction, but not just their ability as a goalkeeper with their hands. I think ball playing wise, they're both absolutely fantastic with the ball at their feet. David Haye's range of passing is brilliant, but Lloris, you know, he does in a way creates an extra player in Spurs' back three that they've been playing at the moment to give them a passing lane, a passing option. So yeah, I think that a player like Lloris, whether he gets a move or not away from Spurs, wherever he goes, he will be a top league keeper in the world. He's definitely up there with the best, I'd say.
And worth noting Sané's contributions, but I thought he was actually really good. Very aggressive, very fast, very direct. Feels like that's the kind of guy they need. The kind of guy that Liverpool may even need, and Sunderland as well. But Liverpool struggled to a 2-3 defeat at home to Swansea.
Can we just quickly go over Poch's tactics? Because people seem to have a problem with City attacking and sort of pinning Tottenham back, and I just don't quite get it.
Did you feel like they were counter-punching almost?
I think they were
trying to.
I think they can be quite a compact side when they want to be, and they have to play in a certain way because of the intensity of the game. And you can see there's certain minutes in the game where they blatantly aren't trying to go forward and they are trying to break on another team. And for some reason, the analysis is that if you aren't attacking, somehow you aren't playing the tactics that your team want. It just doesn't make any sense.
If you're not attacking, then you must be defending and thus doing something wrong.
People seem to have a problem defending in the first place. Maybe it's because the English don't do it very well. I don't know.
Possibly. I think the Premier League's quite an open league as well. I think that plays into it, is that it's a league that's so founded on we have the most goals, we do all this kind of stuff. It certainly seems like there is an issue with you. You have to have control in order to deserve a victory. In that sense, you can't have these smash and grabs anymore. They're not deserved, in brackets or inverted commas. I think if anyone's going to know about Pochettino, though, it is yourself, given you just did that lovely documentary. Another man that you did a documentary on was Jurgen Klopp. As a Liverpool fan, I think, firstly, but then also as a viewer, are you a little bit concerned with this result? Because, again, it does seem not habitual under Klopp, let's say, but you go back to the 90s, Miguel Delaney made a really good point about Liverpool getting that big result in the mid-90s and then stumbling to Coventry City, and how maybe there is a habit to them kind of losing momentum after such a momentous result.
Maybe if we talk a little bit about Klopp and the way that his mentality seems to have spread throughout the squad, the weak points seem to be the areas where he's been able to apply those a little bit less, or he seemed to have broken those areas down himself. So, for instance, you know, he's complained a lot about John Matipo over the last week, not been able to use him directly, but then he brought him on late as a sub. People seem to be trying to blame him for the team that he laid out. I think he's got to take responsibility personally for the goalkeeper situation. You know, he decided to bring one in or bring the other in and maybe not back one or the other. Maybe that's, you know, partly down to the budget that he has. Maybe that's partly down to what he had to do anyway. But I mean, either way, he may have not dealt very well with that goalkeeper situation, even if publicly both of them are speaking in a certain way. We've been saying it on the podcast for a while that Liverpool do need to fix these problems, because the games that they did win, people were willing to heap praise on them and the style. And this is part of the issue, is the analysis goes, if you're attacking, then you must be doing something right. And Liverpool were attacking, and they were doing something right when they were attacking, but they just weren't defending very well. So every time they were getting a win, there was still sort of mass worry and mass panic that, you know, what would happen when teams tried to expose those ways. And ultimately, they, you know, Swansea did expose that they pulled Liverpool from one side to the other, and the ball broke to their players, whether you want to call that luck or whether you want to call it, unfortunate way of having this fall, then... Either way, Liverpool were very fortunate in previous games. Now, Klopp can talk about, the decisions that go against Liverpool, all those kind of things. It's, you know, it smacks a little bit of desperation at that point. I'm not saying he's a desperate manager. I just think he's sort of still looking for solutions. It is also the case that now Liverpool, within the next, I think, 5 games in the Premier League, have Chelsea, Spurs and Arsenal all at home. And the home atmosphere of late has not been great for Liverpool.
What do you attribute that to?
Some people say it's the new stand. Some people say it's that people just don't seem to be as up for it, should we put it that way? I think it isn't great for our home atmosphere right now. And it also doesn't help... that's having spoken to people who have been standing in the Kop, standing in the new stand, standing in the centenary and all these sort of things. And it does seem that sometimes I think the press jump on those things because they're very willing to break down the magic, because it would mean that it's much more of an, you know, a peak and trough situation. It's much easier to report a peak and trough situation than it is to report anything else. The fact is that Liverpool do have two fairly trustable centre-backs there, and two centre-backs that, when they play well, will actually do well, Lovren and Klavan. Nathaniel Klein's been out the side. Klopp's had a fairly thin squad to pick from of late, you could argue, but that still shouldn't be an excuse considering the amount of investment they've had in the squad. And Liverpool are still in a fairly strong position. I guess we'll see. I was very impressed with the way that Swansea compacted themselves.
Yeah, I thought that as well. I thought
Llorente's been a great, great buy.
It didn't seem as if, to me, watching it, they were just behind the ball. It seemed to be some method in there as well, where they were putting themselves, where they were spacing themselves out. It seemed very organised. I thought, and I'm sure we'll come on to it, it was a similar thing with Hall. It felt as if actually there was some genuine detail in there. It wasn't just get behind the ball and build a wall, if you will. Paul Clement, though, Dave, he's someone that didn't have a huge reputation coming into this as a manager. There was a lot of unknowns, I think, when it came to him as a manager. There was a lot of speculation about, well, he's worked with the best as a coach. Have you been impressed with what you've seen so far? Have you been able to glean any insights from what you've seen in this early showing?
I think they set up, you know, sort of a Paul Clement Ancelotti type system, but I think they're getting the better players in the side, and that's what we've seen from Swansea of late. The side looks very, very poor, and I think bringing the likes of Leroy Fer, Jack Cork, and Tom Carroll, obviously signed in from Spurs, is a bit of a better midfield than relegation form. And with Fernando Llorente, they've got a player that can score goals and can work within a system. Obviously, we saw a Bilbao before when he actually was given a run of games and so forth, not at Juventus. He's a top player, so I think they do look a bit better than under previous management. Obviously, our friend Bob, they kind of look a little bit improved, but you know, time will tell. Obviously, Sam Allardyce starting pretty poorly as Crystal Palace manager. I think he's only going to turn that round. So I think with Paul Clement coming in, a big result at Liverpool, but it's got to be, it's next week, you know, it's the next game that he's got to push on again. I think that's got to be his mentality till the end of the season, because what, 2 points outside the drop zone, they've got to keep improving.
I must confess, I was very impressed with Tom Carroll. I think that cross for Llorente's goal, his second, that was fantastic. I think in general his play was really good. It was interesting as well to talk to Spurs fans about him and their perception of him leaving, and the idea that he just wasn't going to break into a midfield that was so technical and so blessed. He's got some difficult games coming up though, has Paul Clement. He's got Southampton at home and City away, Chelsea away. And then he's also got Hull away as well, which is the dreaded six-pointer that we talk about at this point in seemingly in every season. From one promising young English midfielder to another, seamless transition. Good. Tom Davies with Everton. I am a big fan of this guy already, I have to confess. I am firmly on the bandwagon. A beautiful assist for Seamus Coleman as Everton beat Crystal Palace 1-0. Should we be worried at all about Sam Allardyce at this point? Because it does seem as if the usual methods, the usual tactics are not sinking into these Palace players, Lawrence.
Well, I mean, Palace—it's unusual the rollercoaster Palace have been on recently, right? I mean, they had Pulis, and I think they're actually for quite a while quite happy with Pulis, sort of, you know, getting results, keeping them in the league. They sort of had that longevity idea. Going from there, they had, well, I mean, they sort of went down a notch. They've been through the Pardew era, and now they're into Allardyce, which is arguably sort of a mixture of Allardyce with Pardew and Pulis. I mean, it's true though, isn't it?
It is, but I'm just thinking, what a party that sounds like.
It's not a party.
Sprinkling of Pards, bit of Allardyce.
Well, the thing is, Dave's been, and I think Dave's rightly sort of been trying to bring a bit more light onto Allardyce and Pulis and those other guys who've been doing very well in the league. Dave, are you actually a fan of those people, or do you just think they go undervalued?
Well, Tony Pulis and Sam Allardyce, they're quality managers, and if we can't assess that in our game, that
Dave,
these managers
have
been around.
Face, though.
No, I'm being serious. With West Brom and with what Sam Allardyce does with relegation, that's perfect. There's nothing wrong with West Brom right now. They play pretty decent style of football. They've scored a lot of the goals from corners. You know, they scored more corners than any other team in the Premier League, but that's a wet method of scoring. And I think we've come into this world where we stick our noses, we turn our noses up at football like that these days, because there's the pressing, because there's this and there's trendy stuff. When teams defend and when teams defend well and defend with numbers and have very good shape, you know, we kind of look, they're not being Jurgen Klopp, they're not pressing and they're not doing this. But I think there's, you know, we've got to credit that, and that's part of our game. And I think if we forget that part of the game, we forget about a part of our identity, which we don't want to lose in embracing what we actually are and moving forward and creating something that is more than England losing to Iceland in the World Cup.
I think we can remove Pulis from this discussion. I think he's doing very well. That's not going to be debated. The question is, though, David, it's, should we say the summer? It's the July 1st. Or actually, no, I'll take that back. It's the current situation, and you're Crystal Palace's owner, Steve Parrish, and you are presented with the resume of Sam Allardyce and the resume of Hull's new boss. Do you push forward with Allardyce because he's the known quantity, or do you take the risk in what is Silver?
Depends what you want. Depends what your objectives are as a football club. I think that's a big thing. Have you got to stay in the league to balance your books, or are you going to go out of business? You know, as an owner, there's bigger questions than just which one do you think would fit best right now for the future. I think you've got to look at it and say, okay, so let's build on a model. Are we going to go with Marco Silva? If we get relegated, is Marco Silva still going to be manager, or are we going to bin him? Does Marco Silva want to be around there? There's far more questions that you've got to ask than just be like, is it A or B? You know what I mean? There's more things in a football club that have to be acknowledged. Like, for example, if we were building a football club and I was like, okay, right, so we want to build a football club that is going to be safe in the Premier League for the next five seasons, and then when we get to that level of 5 years' time, when we've been a Premier League middle table club, maybe we've dipped in and out of Europe, maybe we've got to a cup semi-final, there's nothing wrong with Sam Allardyce and Tony Pulis. That is stability. Those two managers, although because they get sacked so often because of their boring brand of football in quotation marks, it still has that sort of solidity that keeps teams in the Premier League, and they can defend well. You know, you look at what Sam Allardyce's teams do, you look at Tony Pulis' team, they're very organised, they're very good at defending, they're very good at nicking the small advantages in the small arenas. But and sometimes they hit good form and they really do play some good football. So I think it's that balance between what do you want as a football manager. And in a way, if you are Crystal Palace, that potentially doesn't have the biggest budget, even though they did spend an absolute hatful of cash on Christian Benteke, which massively, for me, is a little bit crazy. A club like that spends $34 million on a striker, a bit mental, but, you know, if you're thinking about your longer term, they need to stay in the Premier League, and Sam Allardyce is the perfect man. And Tony Pulis with West Brom, same thing.
It's
your vision as a manager and your vision as a football club of what you want to do. If you want to play a certain style or certain brand of football, then do that. But then consistently have coaches like that. For example, Hull City, they've gone from Steve Bruce to Marco Silva. Footballing philosophy-wise, that is probably going from, you know, right wing to left wing.
I could definitely see Marco Silva appearing in one of Steve Bruce's books, by the way, as a character. It feels primed for it.
You've got an issue. Swansea City is a perfect example of that. Paul Clement's probably going to come and teach, come back to the possession-based Swansea way. Bob Bradley was probably not playing that style of football. And that's where you lie a problem. If you go from polar to polar, you've got an issue. If you stick, you have a plan. I think that's the problem. Clubs, owners don't have plans. And that's inherently why some football clubs are run in such poor ways.
A very good point. Now, you talked about identity. One thing that seems to be happening at Everton at the minute is the promotion of youth. Now, I briefly had a little bit of an indulgence there with Davies. Obviously, I have Mason Holgate as well. Is this a good thing for Merseyside, Lawrence? Because I read an interview with Davies, who, by the way, seems a fantastic young man. He opted not to take a holiday in Ibiza and other party-like destinations with some teammates, and instead opted to go to Italy and went up Lake Como and all this kind of thing. So he does seem very much bucking the trend of a usual footballer. Is it a good thing for Merseyside, though, Lawrence? Because he says that he's been congratulated by both sides of the city when it comes to his performances.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, if you're a young Scouser, then the city does tend to embrace you, especially if you're representing them well. I think it's also, maybe that relationship goes one way. I'm not saying Everton fans are bitter, but I do think it's easier when your team feel like the bigger team to take someone on, if that makes sense, and sort of be like, oh, he's one of ours, you know?
Could it influence the way Liverpool operate? Could it see Klopp start to think, you know what, I've got to start giving these young chaps more of an opportunity first team in the Premier League?
He's not, obviously Trent Alexander-Arnold started against United.
Good point.
You know, that they've started a number of young guys elsewhere. I think it's also that Everton have somewhat been not forced into this sort of situation, but if you look at that squad, it's very different construction to the one of Liverpool's. I also think that Klopp's only recently taken that academy over.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe felt like it wasn't going in the direction that they wanted.
Yes.
Whereas Everton's academy, I think, has been more autonomous for quite a while and has been much more consistent down the years. You can see that's much more of an Everton academy product than a Liverpool academy product of late.
Mm.
So, very cool. You know, I mean, the point is with Everton that, you know, they've wanted to play this style of football for quite some time now, and there's a reason they got rid of David Moyes, or David Moyes moved on, and the club also felt it was the right time for that. You know, and for that reason, I think that the fans will be quite forgiving in that sense of what is happening at the moment to Everton. And I actually think a 1-0 result against Crystal Palace isn't all that bad. The problem being Big Sam, I think Big Sam said, you can see the results of what I do come... When is
March.
It sort of March time?
Which is a great way to keep your job.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the
let's come
is
back to this in 2 months. It'll be fine.
He has sort of taken away from some of that integrity from being found out, hasn't he? Because now when he says something, people sort of think, well, you know, which side are you batting for?
Yes. I mean, the thing to remember is as well, and I think, I know I've seen Sunderland fans remark on this, is that when he kept them up, the January transfer window was huge for him because he got Kone in. I'm trying to think who else. Was it Kirchhoff, I think, came at the same point as well? It was an influential period for the club because he got some key faces in. He seems a little bit more concerned about the club's ability to do that this time round. So, again, if he can't get new faces in, that's when you wonder if things might actually start to be hitting the fan, so to speak, for Palace, because he'll have to work with everyone that's there, and doesn't seem as if he's that eager to do that. Certainly Andros Townsend is someone that is appearing to be on the fringes of things with him. I think he was left on the bench at the weekend, and the talk is that he could be heading back up north.
Isn't that partly
Newcastle.
The problem with Big Sam, though, is that, I mean, I was talking with Duncan Alexander from Opta the other day, and he was saying he watched back the classic side of Bolton that Sam originally constructed a few years ago. That was sort of pre-Van Campo, so it was sort of JJ Okocha, and on the other side there was someone else.
And Simon Charlton at the back.
Sure. And he was sort of saying, you know, it was a strange mix of players who were considered to be too far over the hill by other teams, and sort of players who were considered to be untouchable by others. And ultimately, it was good for Big Sam, but did it serve the club well in the long term?
Yes, that's a very good point. I think people had talked about that when he signs players, do they go on to be sold for more money? And financially, how sort of responsible is his approach? Definitely seen that argument raised before, and I think, you know, it's not a terrible one or a one without evidence. I think you could maybe say that. See, it's difficult. It's Sunderland, which is the more recent example. I think that if you were to sell Kone tomorrow, you'd make a decent profit. Maybe the same with Kirchhoff, but then at West Ham, you've got the likes of Matt Jarvis, who went for, I think he cost 11 million, and then went for about 2 or 3 to Norwich in the end. So he's definitely, what's the word? What's the fancy word for waste? Yes, wasteful. Sometimes with the finances of things. Another manager who actually has been levelled with that same criticism is Mark Hughes up at Stoke City. Now, Dave, you were not able, I think, to see this goal as it happened. But Wayne Rooney is now Manchester United's leading all-time goal scorer. He passes Sir Bobby Charlton. And there was a lovely photo of them in the dressing room afterwards. Does this change your perception of Rooney? Does it maybe make you look at him with a little bit of a sweeter eye? Or are you still of the opinion that you held before?
Well, I think it's the same opinion, right? Why would change my opinion if he scored one goal or 50 more goals? I think it's the same thing. But yeah, it's a great
That wouldn't even change your opinion? Or are you just being facetious? Or am I being facetious? Maybe we're both being facetious.
No, I'm just giving you my opinion as a Manchester United fan, but in terms of his achievement for football, you know, it's a great achievement, scoring 250 goals for any club. In terms of his win rate as well, when Wayne Rooney scored, he's won 86% of his games, which is very, very good. In terms of his goals are important. But yeah, it was a... Another performance for Man United. Next season, will win that game. You know, they keep making seven saves again on top of his eight that he made in the away game earlier on. So again, Lee Grant pretty much has cost United a good four points this season in the Premier League. United came close a number of times. Pogba, Rashford, Lingard hitting the bar. But ultimately, that midfield has got a little bit of a problem in terms of balance without Michael Carrick. Something I'd quite like to see, just a thought I had whilst I was watching the game, I'd quite like to see Paul Pogba play as a number six, maybe as a defensive midfielder when Carrick isn't in the side, and that is just for this season. I feel like, obviously, Paul Pogba's best position is as a left central midfielder in a 4-3-3 at the moment, but given that we won't sign anyone now, our business will be done in the summer, I think that Paul Pogba could be a good option there, because all that Ander Herrera is good with the ball in terms of how he reads the play and stuff. I prefer him further up the pitch so he can be a bit more aggressive. I do think that he will become a deep line playmaker in the latter stage of his career, but right now he's a little bit too square. It's too easy to read. He's not splitting defences. Mm-hmm. He's not moving defences around. I feel Pogba's the only one really in the side that's not Michael Carrick that could potentially do that and keep the tempo at a right level. But again, you know, there's questions defensively for Paul Pogba and in terms of his positioning, and you know, he does drive through sometimes, he'll play a pass and he'll move on, so there's got to be an understanding there. But the midfield just didn't quite work with Fellaini, Herrera, Pogba, how it was set up. And Ibrahimovic, another quiet game, only had one shot on goal, which was blocked. He had a number of chances that he was slid through, sort of on the left side of the goal, but for some reason went for the pass. And maybe he's hitting a little sticky patch, as been pre-seen in the last week's podcast, that Ibra would go on another barren run, but we'll go on to score 20 goals this season, so I'm still not worried. But United, yeah, next season we'll win the league this season. Top four's going to be tough.
Bleach blonde's just sliding on the Dulux scale for you, though, aren't you? Because you're kind of a dirty blonde. So it's not the most drastic transition. Anyway, I'm digressing.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that a goalkeeper costs Manchester United points this season? From a United perspective, though, surely.
Yeah, obviously from a United perspective, his performances have cost United 4 points. That he's put in really, he's putting two, not match winning, but match drawing performances in terms of the saves that he's made against United this season.
Could you not also just then say that could you also flip that and then say the Manchester United players have cost the team so many points?
If you're looking at data in terms of the state saves a keeper makes, you're averaging, you know, just over two saves a game. So if a keeper's pulling out seven saves, all shots on target, you're highlighting a very decent performance. So if he's doing that in one of the games and then the other game he's made eight saves, so you're rocking four times the average of saves a keeper would make in a game, I think you can highlight a very, very good performance there. But obviously, in terms of finishing, there's some young players in there that could potentially have finished better. The likes of Rashford, the likes of Paul Pogba, the likes of Jesse Lingard, who's not young anymore. But in a way, Lee Grant won them the points. Won them the point, should I say.
How can you say that, though, if, say, all the shots are at him, or all the shots are easy, then that's not a great performance from a goalkeeper. That's the players putting the ball at him and he's making saves that he should be making.
But again, that wasn't the case in the two games. You go back to the home game, the save he made on Zlatan Ibrahimovic's scissor kick.
That's one of eight.
The save that he made against Marouane Fellaini, the save he made against Paul Pogba in the return picture. There's saves there without going into each save and breaking down whether that was a good save or not save, or whether that was aim or not them. When you've got a level of saves that's around eight and seven, the keeper's had a good game no matter what. I don't think you... Obviously, you can distinguish the finishing could have been better and so forth, but the keeper has had a good game. You've got to give him that. You've got to give him the man of the match award. You've got to give him the champagne. You've got to give him a hug, and you've got to be like, well played, sir. In some teams, you know, you can't beat this goalkeeper. And that, unfortunately, has been United's issue with a number of keepers this season.
There we go. Now, my wonderful notes that Lawrence prepared tells me that Hotel Football had a nice banner on the side saying Rooney with 250 overs. That's a lovely way to commemorate it. And congratulations, Wayne, because in fairness, scoring 250 goals I don't think is as easy as people would like you to believe. And as much criticism as he gets, I think it's a fairly decent achievement, given the way that he was thrust in the limelight at a fairly young age. Now, Dave, you raised a point about Pogba there. Am I correct in saying, yes and no will suffice, that you think Pogba works better when Carrick is on the field?
I feel he works better with a deep line playmaker behind him. That's just Paul Pogba fact over his careers as a footballer so far.
Brilliant. The reason I ask is because there is a lovely chap who did an interesting article, and I will segue this beautifully, don't worry, that suggests that actually Carrick is the best partner for Pogba because of how often he gives him the ball. Now, that might sound like common sense, but actually there's an analytic that looks at possession usage, and I'll link the piece on our social media so you guys can read it yourselves. But it's the idea of how often does a player use possession, i.e. shoot, whatever, lose the ball. And it's a really interesting way to look at Memphis and why he didn't seem to work at Manchester United. Dave, are you terribly disappointed that Memphis has gone to Lyon? He's currently sitting on the bench for them, I believe, in their game against Marseille.
No, I don't know. There's a problem there. I think Memphis Depay had 18 months at Manchester United. Unfortunately, didn't show his form that he showed at PSV and Eindhoven in the Eredivisie. And as United have, they did have, what, seven players that can play right midfield and left midfield. Unfortunately, Memphis's flexibility has let him down. His ability to adapt at a new football club and adapt to a new defensive system has cost him his Manchester United career. And unfortunately, that's it.
The key question here is why, and this is where the article, I think, comes into its own. It theorises that if you look at his time at PSV, he was a lot more influential in terms of the ball and being given the ball. I think it said 20% of possessions ended with him, whereas that dropped to about 12% when he was at Manchester United. So he wasn't being given as many opportunities. Now, Dave, is that something you would agree with, that perhaps the ball maybe wasn't being run through Memphis as much, and that moving to a club like Lyon, which is still a big club, would be more beneficial to him in terms of getting him the ball and giving him those chances?
Well, I think you've got to look at the styles of football of those two clubs. PSV Eindhoven were a very direct side with Luke de Jong. He used to play for Newcastle. They were very direct. They used him as a target man, and Memphis played next to him, pretty much as a striker on the left wing. And I think that's the difference between the Man United team that he came to. He came to a Louis van Gaal Man United team where the wingers aren't getting that much ball. They're getting the ball, as you mentioned, probably seven times less than he was in the direct team that he played for. So he was required to do more with the ball, which unfortunately cost him mentally and made him very easy to read in terms of the move that he was going to pull, come onto that left foot, shoot a goal and so forth. And that is one of the issues of Memphis Depay, not just his decision-making when he's defending, his decision-making when he's attacking. Strikers need to, if you're playing on the left-hand side or you're playing on the right-hand side, you can't do the same thing every time for your fullback, because he can start to read it and start to telegraph it. You need to run your fullback sometimes. Memphis didn't do that enough. You need to come short, pick up the ball, turn, drive. Memphis didn't do that enough. You need to pull on, hug the wing sometimes, pull the fullback wide, then go on the outside. Every single time Memphis got the ball when he was in a wide position, strong onto the right foot. And unfortunately, that was it. The catalyst of Memphis' problems. When he could have received the ball, popped it off, made a run in behind, got the ball, received it, pushed it back and retained possession. Unfortunately, Memphis didn't do that enough. And its decision-making has cost him this Man United career, unfortunately. And that is, you know, whether you show it by numbers, whether you show it by tactical analysis, or you show it by whatever, it's his thinking of interpreting certain positions has cost him, you know, his transfer. And that's unfortunately it. But going back to Lyon, you've got a team that's got a lot of fresh forwards, you know, the likes of Lacazette, the likes of Fekir. That's a very pacey front three with Memphis Depay in there. So it's going to be exciting, this Lyon team. And I imagine they potentially will be a little bit more quicker with possession through Tolisso, through to Memphis in the front three, because it's, you know, the most exciting attacking part of their side.
I feel like John Barnes wrote some very helpful advice on how to make decisions that may be far too niche for our audience. You never know. We'll see. Another man that hasn't been playing too much is Saido Berahino. Someone that's probably not on Jeremy Pearce's Christmas card list and vice versa. He completed a move to Stoke City this week and cost an initial $12 million, rising to $15 million. First and foremost, Lawrence, is this a good deal for Stoke? Is it worth that risk?
I think in terms of what Mark Hughes wants in a striker, it probably is. It probably completes that front line they've been struggling to fill more recently. Crouch has been the number one option up there. That's given them some nice ball holding skills and some bit more flexibility in bringing wingers into the game, which has been nice. It's been great to see it, the way that he's stretched other sides. They certainly did that against Liverpool and a couple of other teams where they got the victory in the end. But I think it more or less started against Liverpool when Crouch came back into the side after talking about wanting a new contract, which he ultimately got, even considering his age. And, you know, it gives you a number of options. You can play a little man, big man combo, or you can just stick Saido on by himself. And also, considering he's being banded around for just 30 a few seasons ago when he was on his way to Spurs, allegedly, this does now look like a good deal. you know, considering the market's inflated in the first place, and he counts as an English player. I just think we're all going to miss Saido. That's what I'm going to miss most. That is time.
I definitely think that West Brom will be disappointed with this. When, because you make a fantastic point there that they, I think they turned down 20 million from Spurs, but there was some like rising to 25, and now they've got 12 to 15, which admittedly for a guy that's in the final few months of his contract, that's not terrible business. But I think when you give it that context, it's really not
I
that
think,
great.
I think Berahino will also be disappointed in this because he's technically taken a move from one team to another team when he was looking to take a move up to the next level and essentially play alongside what he thought would be his future England strike partner, Harry Kane.
Yes, again, another fantastic point. And one that I think West Brom fans have made is that really nobody wins in this because the club have lost money on a prospect, but also Berahino's lost a good portion of his early career and he's moved sideways, which I don't think is...
And arguably, you know, under a manager like Pochettino, it would have been fantastic to see what he could have developed into.
Yes.
Well, I'm not saying this, that's no slur on Mark Hughes.
No, because Mark Hughes was a fantastic striker in his day, and I'm sure can teach him some wonderful things as well. But it's a valid point. And it does seem as if that may spell the end of Boney in the first team. I know Stoke fans weren't exactly delighted with his presence there. Dave, moving slightly sideways. I can't think of a wonderful segue for this, sadly.
Maybe he could have gone to Germany.
Maybe from Berahino to near Berlin, he says, guessing geography in Germany. You've been away, as we alluded to at the start there, less than subtly. What was it about? Tell us more. Fill us in.
I'm joining the revolution in Eastern Germany, and it's starting soon. So, you know, I've got to lay the ground rules and so forth in football.
Episode, it's already gone political. Great. To see RB Leipzig, of course, against Frankfurt. What were your opinions of the game, more importantly? Because obviously it was a fairly convincing win for Leipzig. I think they won 3-0. But from someone that was in the stadium, what did you take away from it tactically?
Yeah, it was a good game. I think Leipzig, as they've shown this season, are hyper-flexible with the ball, without the ball. In terms of how they attack and in terms of how they press, it's very refreshing to see. They're a very young side and obviously they play with two forwards, but I think it's in terms of the midfield, it's just fascinating to see them move all together in unison, and it's a very impressive sort of way of playing football and developing young players and really getting the best out of what you've got. And obviously this Leipzig thing, there's been a lot of work done on it and there's a lot of negativity around it in terms of German fans, you know, pigs heads and whatever. But quite frankly, if you go to the stadium, you speak to anyone around Leipzig, you know, you see it. It's they're happy about it. It's the first team in 20 years that a team from Eastern Germany is in the Bundesliga, and a first team you know, that Leipzig have had for years and years and years, and they are competitive, and they do sign these young players that are very exciting. Players like Keita, who was excellent in the game, so good. You know, Forsberg has been their best player this year for me in terms of his assists and creativity coming in from the left wing, coming into number 10, sort of what Shinji Kagawa used to do for Borussia Dortmund. You see him do that, Keita do that for the 90 minutes against Frankfurt. My man of the match by a country mile. Was so good, grabbed himself an assist countless times, turned over the ball. It was so difficult to get off the ball, and it wasn't dribbling for dribbling's sake. It was dribbling in very dangerous areas. Obviously drew the foul for the second goal and then whipped in the ball for Timo Werner to put the ball in the back of net. But it was a very positive crowd, and something that you'll be able to see on our YouTube channel in the coming days, the experience of Red Bull. And I'd say, yeah, if you've got time, you've got the money, get over to Leipzig. It's 26 quid, I think, they've paid for the flight, £55 for the Airbnb. So it's cheap. And a €15 ticket. So it's a very good experience for under £100 to go and see some good football and a very young, exciting team.
There you go. 50 quid for the flight, but the memories are priceless. Now, one person who's teased something wonderfully in the same way that Dave did there with that video is Dimitri Payet talking about his future. Slaven Bilic said, "You lose something and you gain something, but it would be ridiculous for me to say we don't miss him playing after their 3-1 win against Middlesbrough." Lawrence, should they be concerned about the Payet situation? They are scoring goals. Admittedly, Jonathan Caleri looks like leaving after scoring his first goal, which is, you know, going out on a high at least. But with Andy Carroll and those around him, It does seem like a situation that is unfolding as well as it possibly could for West Ham.
Well, yeah, I mean, the pilot leading... Oh, Dave's going. Dave, are you leaving?
Hold on, 2 seconds.
Oh, Dave's not leaving.
Oh, it's like Paye all over again.
Yeah, I know.
Is he going? Is he staying?
Dave was actually doing a very small commentary on modern football there. that was actually the conversation between Bilic and Paye at one point. He went, "You just want to go." Yeah, that's fair enough. I remember when it was like this for me. Ultimately, yes. I think the point is that they should have gotten rid of or should have let Payet leave in the summer. I think they were disappointed with the quality of the offers or interest that maybe came in. Payet maybe was similar. And it would have been diligent and maybe clever, savvy to have cashed in at that point. But they didn't. And now
it feels like that episode, you know, the TV show Pawn Stars, where they go in and they honestly, believe this item is... So... For those unaware, but essentially it's a program, I think, on the History Channel, where people go into pawnbrokers and sell their stuff.
Ah, yeah, okay, I think I've seen like.
And there's many a hilarious instance where someone comes in and says, "I have this item," you know, a camera once owned by Lawrence McKenna, famed director.
Got you.
"I want £50,000 for it," and the guy will often say, "I need to bring an expert in," and the expert will say, "Honestly, that's not worth more than £500," and it's that awkward moment where someone. Camera, mate. Well, okay, 600. You've twisted me arm.
I wanted a grand.
But there's that awkward moment where the person is left disappointed knowing that they're not getting even a tenth of what they expected. And yeah. It does seem as if West Ham left in that same predicament.
Do you think it's also, though, that people sort of see how well he fitted in with West Ham and sort of think, okay, he had all those great moments. Maybe we could reproduce those. Maybe. But part of the problem is that like Dave said, and like a number of other people have said, the issue will come that he is A, an ageing player, so won't maybe be able to fit into other systems so well if they're not built around him. But B, he also maybe won't fit so well into another system if he's not willing to work.
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head there that essentially his age is an issue, of course, but also he is the band leader at West Ham and was when he was doing his best work. And to give that much commitment to a player, I think as West Ham maybe feared when he said he wanted to leave, is that if that person downs tools, then what do you do? Because you've invested not just the time and money.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Funny in the man that is Dimitri Payet, you've also given him the keys to your attack and realistically, I would imagine, shaped your recruitment around that because you can't house two players of his quality with the same requirements in terms of I want to be central to the team and keep both happy. I think you make some more than valid points regarding him and where West Ham went wrong.
Where they went right, though, is Andy Carroll coming back at the right time. The key is to keeping him fit all that time. Is it possible?
It's a difficult one. I mean, he had injuries even early in his career. He had a bad ankle injury, I remember, quite when he was young. And the thing is, and I've heard players talk about this, if it's a long-term injury, like Jay Rodriguez, for example, where he has a bad knee injury or something like that, you think, okay, well, that's often quite unfortunate luck. It's when they pick up the little strains, the little tweaks now and again. Craig Bellamy, a former West Ham player, nonetheless, was quite susceptible to them. Now, the thing that was interesting about him was when he went to, I believe, Manchester City, he was given a special training program by a Dutch fitness coach. His name escapes me. And that seemed to turn things around for him. He played a lot more games. He wasn't nearly as intense with his sessions. And it just made things a little bit easier for him and his body. And I think, actually, that was one of the reasons he ended up leaving Man City, was that they tried to change him doing that.
Was that the same coach, Chris, who was critical of Jurgen Klopp this time around when he came to the country and said the same of Conte and his training methods, that they were too intense?
I know the chap you're talking about. Is it Raymond Verheyen?
I'm not saying, yeah.
Along those lines. I wouldn't want to misspeak and say, yes, it is, if I'm not 100% sure.
Sure.
But it was definitely something that influenced Bellamy's career greatly, and maybe something that Carroll can consider, because I think that's the difficulty, is in the same way that your man management approach needs to be tailored to the individual, it makes sense to tailor the physical as well, because, again, not everyone's body reacts the same. Not everyone is as naturally fit and seemingly timeless as, let's say, Ryan Giggs or players of that ilk who do seem to be able to train 5 days a week and be totally fine with it, and then handle a game on a Saturday. So it'll be an interesting one to watch. I hope for Andy's sake that he does get that regular time, because an injury can be so destabilising to a player's momentum, but also their confidence as well. When you manage to get that little bit of regular game time and then it stops and you have to come back and you have to shake the rust off, because it is a real thing, the playing rust. I've heard a number of players talk about how you're just not as sharp when you get back on the field that first few times. It takes maybe a game or two to get where you need to be. A team that are fast running out of games is Sunderland. The Black Cats and David Moyes travelled down to West Brom and were, I'd say, fairly comprehensively beaten 2-0. There wasn't really much of a fight from Sunderland on this one. And interestingly, it's emerging late on Sunday night that they are considering selling Patrick Van Aanholt to Crystal Palace and Sam Allardyce. That, to me, seems like a very bold decision. It will give David Moyes money. But is that the best way to look at things, Lawrence, is to take that £10 million if that's what the fee is to be and say, okay, let's see who we can get, maybe someone more influential in a central position?
I suppose it depends who they get in for that money, doesn't it? I mean, we don't know who's on their radar, but I think what we've seen is that, you know, this side predominantly relies on having a solid defensive base when David Moyes' teams tend to turn up. So the frustration might come in that... You know, that they get rid of someone back there and then they're not able to plug that gap. Who would go in his position instead of Van Aanholt would be my question.
Ooh, maybe Billy Jones. They, in fairness to Sunderland, they do have some promising youngsters. In fact, George Honeyman came on, I think he started actually, against West Brom on Saturday and looked fairly decent in flickers. Again, he's only a young man, so he's... maybe not huge amounts expected of him. And it's a difficult situation to go in as a young player when the team is losing like that. So maybe a young guy gets thrown in and sees how he can perform. In fact, Sunderland's elite development squad, as the term is these days, is, from what I can see, performing fairly well, or at least has whenever I've been able to catch them. That's why Lyndon Cooch got promoted to the first team before his unfortunate injury. So... who knows? The concern for me is John O'Shea is really starting to look his age. There was an awkward moment when Matt Phillips poked the ball through his legs, and the turn, the run, they all looked incredibly slow. And I'd be very surprised if John O'Shea takes up professional football next season, because I think his best days are firmly behind him. But credit to West Brom again. They're playing some very attacking football. And they are scoring some beautiful goals as well. Chris Brunt, in particular, was an absolute peach of a strike and one that he certainly seemed to enjoy. What's the next
contrast,
step,
isn't it, though, Chris? Well, I mean, that's the point, isn't it, Chris?
There's
actually
a
massive contrast between what West Brom have got there, two experienced players who look sharp under a manager, compared with a load of experienced players who maybe don't look as sharp.
Yes, it's... To borrow an analogy, it's like fruit. There's a point that ripe becomes rotten. And I think that's, unfortunately, the issue with Sunderland is that the likes of Wes Brown, who obviously left last season, and John O'Shea have just stayed there a little bit too long, I think. They're not... Maybe if they were in reduced roles, I could understand it. You know, maybe teaching the likes of Kone and Digibody and people like that. By the way, Digibody is almost guaranteed to be banned off the back of this. For levelling a punch at, I think it was Darren Fletcher, who got the other goal. He has been nothing short of a car crash since he arrived, which honestly surprised me. I mean, admittedly, he was playing in a struggling Werder Bremen team last year, but his numbers were fairly comparable to Kone. So the thought at the time was that they were going to sell Kone and Digibody would be the replacement. He's definitely not that. He is a really... just someone that seems to lack composure at all times. I mean, I say that knowing that I believe he was the same chap who was banned in the Bundesliga for performing a throat slit gesture to an opponent. So, again, he clearly has a little bit of history with this, but it's a massive concern for Sunderland. Whereas West Brom, you would argue, again, it's that next step for them now. Who do they bring in? Where do you start to improve the team? That's the thing. It's not a case of we need a replacement. It's a case of we need an improvement. Which is never a bad position to be in for any team.
True.
Nonetheless, Pulis. Going slightly further south, Bournemouth 2-2. This was a fairly pulsating game, which is not a word I get to use that often.
Especially not between Watford and Bournemouth.
Exactly. But Eddie Howe's team, as you rightly remarked to me before, they're conceding a lot of goals at the minute. Their defence... it was a defence that I think when they came up, we looked at and we said, you know what, this is not the best back four in the league. It could be in for some real smackings. And it seems that's finally coming home to roost now. They also lost Nathan Ake, which seems to have been a fairly big blow for them.
Mm.
Is it as simple as just going out and buying a new defender?
Well, I mean, it should be. The problem for them being that they are sort of working on a budget there. I also think... that for them, is it more than want to try and bring youth in? They want to try and build for the future. The thing is, how many people can they bring in on the budget they have to get someone who's going to be able to A, come speed fast enough, and B, be able to defend in the way that they want?
So, Dave, is there a defender you would suggest for Bournemouth as a possible person to fix these leaky holes? Because we're talking about improving them just as on an individual player-to-player basis. Is there someone you would suggest?
I think it's difficult, isn't it? Because Nathan Ake has been so good for Bournemouth this season. And maybe it's something that they need to do for next season if they do fill a hole with a loan player to sign it for the whole season. Because it seemed that someone like Nathan Ake that's so been so pivotal in the first half of the season that instantly is recalled to Chelsea and is now sitting on the bench, they do look a little bit leaky. In terms of players, I'd say maybe look abroad, go to the likes of Italy. And the thing with Bournemouth is that obviously the money-wise, it's going to be so difficult. They're going to have to pick somebody up from completely under the radar, and then bring them over to Bournemouth, try and sell them the dream that they're going to be in the Premier League next season. But it's just a gamble. If you are going to get these young players and they do perform, maybe you should have something in the contract to say, look, they've got to stay until June to sort themselves out. But yeah, budget-wise, it's difficult for Bournemouth. I think that's the big thing. They're probably going to have to stick with what they've got.
Red Bull Leipzig, or RB Leipzig, excuse me, Freudian slip, they have some decent defenders. They're not Orban. He looks quite handy. I'm not saying it's a doable deal, but again, he seems like the kind of defender that they could use. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, I think, in terms of, you'd say Nathan Ake, what's been playing between left-back and centre-back, so in terms of Red Bull, maybe a fullback. Bernardo was very, very good against Eintracht Frankfurt, got forward very, very well in the first half. There was something they were working on before the game, in the warm-up, they were working on low crosses to the near post, and it was something that was prevalent through the first half an hour of the game, first 45 minutes, that they were hitting these low crosses, and they created three really good opportunities there. But Bernardo was the guy that was on the overlap, that was putting the balls into the box. But unfortunately, he plays on the right-hand side, not the left-hand side. Willy Oban has had a very good Bundesliga this season, but I doubt they're going to be letting them go. In terms of Leipzig, why would you sell? And Bournemouth would have to have a little bit more financial muscle than they have.
Yes, this is all very true. Now, in fairness, it's worth noting as well that actually Bournemouth got a little bit of a hand from a Watford defender, Christian Cabasele, who just fell to the floor, basically, and decided that the game had to stop and the referee did not agree. did either of you see this? It seemed very bizarre for him to just stop like that, because I think essentially he took one in the sensitive region, to use a delicate phrase, and then seemed to just lie down.
I didn't see that one, but I've seen two very silly goalkeeping decisions in the Bundesliga this weekend. The first one was I think it was the Hamburg goalkeeper who caught Marco Reus on the thigh when he was clean for own goal. Absolutely incredible. And then the Frankfurt keeper literally ran out of his box and dived on the ball like he was within his penalty area and literally picked it up and got sent off within 2-3 minutes. Completely changed the game there. So there's been a bit of craziness going around in terms of goalkeepers in the Bundesliga, but not midfielders or defenders.
Madness. Lawrence, you nodded there as if to say that you did see this. Again, is Etienne Capoue, who gave him a nice little love tap on the back of the head, is he right to get annoyed? Should they have been a little bit better organised in general?
Well, I mean, if someone goes down, then they...
Careful.
The problem is if a player's down, it's then open to the referee, isn't it? You essentially play to the whistle, but then you're kind of relying on the referee to back you up. And, you know, if you're in pain, especially in certain areas, then you can't necessarily stand up.
All very good and rational points.
No, it's true. I mean, the point is, it's sort of in the spirit of the game, isn't it? I mean, if someone's... That's the problem, is if someone sort of taps you in that area, you really need to be hit very specifically, don't you?
Mm. No, I think you make a very valid point. Curiosity.
What would you do if you were the ref and you knew someone had been hitting the balls?
I'd have a lot of sympathy, first and foremost, before I'd do anything with the whistle. I would have a lot of sympathy.
Where are you putting the whistle?
I think you're right, though. I think he has to stand up and he has to stay focused. Even if he just fouls someone, just, you know, you have to either take the momentum out of the game or something. You can't just stop.
I mean, technically you can. Other players have and have gone down and then have then taken themselves off the pitch.
It's a risk, though, isn't it? I think as we saw with Crystal Palace and that young chap who tried to essentially shimmy his way back onto the pitch to stop Everton playing. It's not within the spirit of the game. Is it a little bit concerning that Watford can't seem to keep clean sheets at the minute? They got one against Middlesbrough, obviously, but that was a goalless draw. Prior to that, I'm really not seeing many here.
No, correct.
And you would assume Walter Mazzari would be able to kind of build up. They do seem like they've got some solid enough defenders, some good defensive midfielders, Barami, Capoue. Is it a concern, Dave, that they can't keep clean sheets?
They've got Younes Kabul in their back three. That's suicidal for any defence. So that you can't keep clean sheets of Younes Kabul in there. He's been very poor this season. And I think that's one of the big things that potentially they've got to address, is getting another centre-back if they're going to play three.
So they have similar issues in that sense, Bournemouth and Watford.
Yeah, both need to get someone in the last, 8 days of the window?
I sometimes wonder if Liverpool had enough personnel, if they'd be better off playing three at the back. But maybe that goes against their gegenpressing. But, you know, with it being trendy and getting width that maybe Klopp needs from the likes of Milner and whoever he plays, whether it's Trent Alexander-Arnold or Klein, whether that would work quite well. Also considering they don't get much cover from the midfield.
Well, that's the curious thing with Watford as well, isn't it? Obviously, they have this partnership with Udinese and Granada. Granada, I don't think, are doing too well this season. Udinese, with Watford sitting in 14th, is the temptation maybe to send someone across from there? I mean, they've got... The guy that's impressed me whenever I've seen him for Udinese is Seko Fofana, who was at City. But a defender in general, they've got Gabriel Angela, who played for Watford before. Is it worth, Dave, taking that risk and just sending someone over in the hopes that it kind of changes things?
I think there's always hope in that way. I think, you know, in terms of what you're going to get out of that, the benefits massively outweigh what the time that you're going to spend doing that. So, yeah, I'd say it's definitely worth it.
I guess we'll have to see if that one comes to the fore. A team that just got rid of a defender, Jose Fonte of Southampton, who moved to West Ham.
Very happily as well, by the sounds of it.
Yeah,
delighted with 8 million, weren't they?
For 33-year-old. Yeah, crikey. That's Hugh Grant money, that. You're not paying 8 million for a 33-year-old. No, in terms of that's how much he would command for a film in his pomp.
No, I understand. Yep.
Not that look, not every transition is smooth.
33-year-old, got you.
Not every duck lands on the water seamlessly. Southampton with 3-0 winners over Leicester, fairly comfortable. Leicester. I was thinking about this today. You win the Premier League, but then the next few seasons are really tough. Are you bothered? Do you just put the DVD on at the end of the weekend and just relive it?
They do sit 5 points above the relegation zone at the moment, though. So, you know, not so terrible, especially when you look at the fixtures they've got ahead. They've got, Burnley, Swansea, then they play Sevilla. In between, obviously, they've got Manchester United and Liverpool, but then they play Hull and people like that. So it's not. So I think they can pick up enough points to get to 40 at this point in the season, to be honest.
Mm. Dave, as our tactician of sorts, this can't be as simple as Kante going, can it?
No, I think it's you've got to move your side on. I think if you win the Premier League or you win a league, you've got to think about the next year. And that's what Sir Alex Ferguson did so well, was evolving his side. And unfortunately, Ranieri's come into the season, has played the same way, obviously, without Kante. So you're already downgrading one of your best players, which is a big thing in terms of turning the ball over. But they've not moved their approach. And unfortunately, that's cost them. They should have potentially moved to a more, changed the system up, just done something a bit different. So you weren't playing the same Leicester City that everyone's researched over the whole of the summer break. They're like, okay, how do Leicester City play? You know, the opt-in scouts and so forth. We've watched a lot of Leicester City, and I feel that you've got to be able to throw another card out there. Unfortunately, they're playing the same way that they played last season, and that's really costing them. But there was some poor performances. I heard a 606 interview that jumped on my Twitter timeline that was saying something like, obviously, Ranieri's got to go, a fan that was really annoyed with the players and so forth. And obviously, that's a little bit over the top in terms of what he's done. You know, he won the Premier League last season. You've got to give him more than half a season or three quarters of a season, right?
Yes. No, I would be inclined to agree with that. No, worth noting as well, Yoshida came in to the back line as well. You would argue that Southampton are the kind of club that Leicester need to look at. Am I wrong in thinking this? That their ability to transition seamlessly from losing Lallana or Schneiderlin or whomever, that's the kind of approach that you need to think, okay, if we lose player X, if we lose Dave O'Brien from the heart of our defence, we can go out. We can
the club. Lost the ball player there, Chris. You lost your sweeper, your libero, your heartbeat of your side, the guy that's going to switch the play, the guy that's going to make the tackles. It's game over.
Right, there you go, convincing. But the point stands that, again, Southampton seem able to transition very well.
They built a system that creates, that means that you lose a coach, a scout, you can replenish him with somebody else that you've picked up in the market, be it a player, whatever. You know, anything that's within a football club. The problem with Leicester City is that they had that, because it's Steve Walsh that's now gone to Everton, that was, in quotation marks, the guy that picked Mahrez and picked Kante out of obscurity. The thing with that is, stats are interesting, and Kante was a player that statistically was standout by a country mile in the league in terms of ball winning the ball back, and sometimes it don't work out with those players. Sometimes they do step up to certain leagues, sometimes they don't. So yeah, 2 times out of 10, you might get it right. But unfortunately, Leicester City needed to get it really right replacing Kante. And unfortunately, they've not done that. And we've seen a number of players come in and try and fulfil that position. Mendy, Amati, and they just haven't got to that same level. So unfortunately, Leicester City may need to find another string to their bow or a new system to accommodate the force they have this season. Ahmed Nusa is a brilliant sign, again, I mentioned before. And I really like him as a player. So it's maybe getting him and Jamie Vardy in the same side.
Interesting. Now, one man that got it right if you were an Arsenal fan or wrong if you were a Burnley fan was Chris Moss, who I believe is the referee today, as Arsenal ran out 2-1 winners against Burnley. Two goals basically inside injury time here, Lawrence. I saw an interesting report with Sportsnet that suggested that Arsenal's mentality was an issue. Is that something we can draw from this? I mean, they did win. You would argue from the Machiavellian standpoint, perhaps, that the ends justify the means, that they did still come out with a result and still pushed, even though they were down to 10 men after losing Granit Xhaka.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, you could probably spin it either way at this point. Arsenal, you know, I spoke to an Arsenal fan the other day on Slash, and they were sort of saying, well, you know, whatever way we would have done it, you'd have painted it that way. The problem being that Well, yeah. I mean, if you do allow a team, the problem is Burnley are actually a pretty good side at the moment, and so they deserve the respect of the rest of the league. The problem also being that Arsenal are also a very good side. The issue is with Arsenal, they're not necessarily consistent in the way that they play.
Yes.
And so it makes it very hard to analyse them week in, week out. And they also have players who are very difficult to analyse in the way that they play, such as Alexis Sanchez, such as Olivier Giroud, because they don't fit the archetypes that we normally sort of associate with those roles. I mean, you know, they both seem like quite... not delicate seems like the wrong word, but apparently Alexis Sanchez does need to be cared for quite a lot. And Olivier Giroud needs to have a certain condition to play in, if that makes sense. I am a little bit confused by the coverage of Xhaka. You know, I mean, Arsenal Fan TV, like has been mentioned quite a lot, sort of said...
called him a ham roll.
Yeah, but he also said he got a red card every week in the Bundesliga.
Which was an impressive feat. He has, I believe, been sent off 8 or 9 times now in his career, which is concerning. And in fairness, someone, I can't remember their name, apologies.
It was a straight red, to be fair.
Yeah, did tweet me and say this. You know, they knew what they were getting with him. And again, I said as much myself, that every profile you read about him this summer said he has discipline issues. The timing of his tackles, he's not necessarily a dirty player or someone that looks to injure. It's just the timing of his tackles that is the issue with Xhaka. You've got to think, is this something they can maintain? Because again, you know, like so much of this is about, you know, how you perceive things. It doesn't impact them today because they get the win. You've got to think there comes a moment where it does, though, and where it does cost them, maybe against a team higher up the division that can make that extra man count.
I suppose the point is they you know, they bought on Coquelin today, and that made all the difference. Cazorla has obviously got his Achilles, I think it's an Achilles injury. Elneny is off at the African Cup of Nations. And any other player...
I'm talking about specifically in the game, though. That's the thing. I'm talking about in the moment.
I mean, clearly it did make a difference the way that they were playing because it no longer allowed them to build from where they were. It would be fantastic if they could transition someone slightly further back. I mean... Yeah, I mean, the problem with Ozil, it would be lovely if Ozil could play a little deeper. But then that's not really his position, is it? If I'm quite honest, I'd be interested to see what someone like Alexis Sanchez would do in that position, because if he can press and push higher up the field, God knows, it'd be interesting to see what would happen if you ran into Alexis Sanchez at that point on the pitch and how well Arsenal's counter-attacks would go.
I'm glad you mentioned Alexis, because our good friend Carlos Zaldivar tweeted us saying, "Alexis is something else, huh? Seems a player with such high confidence, yet without seeming arrogant." I think that's a fair way to characterise.
I don't think he's arrogant, though. I do think he needs, I'm told, needs care from whichever manager it is.
I thought you were going to say a ball full of exclusively blue M&Ms.
No, although, you know, apparently he needs care.
That makes sense, though. I mean, his future is the topic of debate still. There's no guarantees about where he stays. He did take that penalty incredibly confidently, though. That could have really blown up in his face if it didn't go the right way. Do you think there's maybe part of him, when you talk about the care, is there part of him that, whether he wants to admit it or not, this is the perfect situation for him? Because he is, as we talked about with Payet, the band leader. He is the one that they all look to, that, for goodness sake, Arsenal fans just produced a giant banner that had pictures of his dogs on it. They clearly adore him at that football club and would be devastated if he leaves. And yet also he seems to be the type of guy that, while not arrogant, as Carlos rightly makes the point, does seem to want to be appreciated at all times.
I guess he does want to be appreciated, and he will be appreciated. The I guess what we are assuming, and every fan base sort of assumes, is that we're the only ones that can appreciate him. You know, so, and sometimes that is the case. But what I do wonder is, when Arsenal fans or other fans sort of say, well, you know, we're the only ones that can appreciate him in this specific way, is that necessarily the case? You know, I mean, Liverpool fans sort of felt the same about Fernando Torres, and ultimately Torres had to leave the club to find out that was the case. He did fit in particularly well there. And, you know, you could say the same about so many strikers that have passed through a lot of different clubs. They've found their place, and then they've maybe taken it for granted. And, you know, I would also argue that I think foreign players in any walk of life in England get portrayed quite badly because they're seen as money grabbing in some way. And if an English player wants to move, he's seen as, you know, aspiring. If a foreign player wants to move, he's seen as not.
Yes, that can often be the case. One man who's not taking anything for granted, though, is Antonio Conte, and his Chelsea side ran out 2-0 winners against Hull City. Now, it depends how you view Hull on this one. I thought, yes, they were beaten fairly comfortably. I did see flickers of something, though. I saw flickers of potential there, that they were able to keep the ball for moments.
There was 20 minutes where Hull were the attacking side, and the problem is, again, maybe that Chelsea were judged to be very dominant, which they were. They didn't make that dominance count in that time, and arguably, you know, Dave can Dave's gone now, but Dave could reference that, you know, they had a lot of shots in that time, they had a lot of chances, but you know, the argument against that would be, well, you didn't convert those, but the good thing is that they did convert some of them, and Diego Costa was on the pitch. Fantastic for him, fantastic for Chelsea. Shows in some way that Conte had the control and it was never really out of his hands. But the point is, with Hull, that then there was 20 minutes where Hull got very close, and had they scored in that time, could have been a very different game. But again, the answer would be they didn't.
Yes, this is true. Chelsea again, though. Diego Costa, I believe it's 52-100 now, and it's something about modern society where you can't tweet out anything commending one player without the fans of other clubs rushing in and saying, ah, yes, but this player, Sergio Aguero or Harry Kane, has an even better record. Nothing can be appreciated in isolation. It must be comparable to other things. That is a strong record, though. Do you think that the talk of China was a little bit misleading, that realistically it was something he considered? And I say this because I read that Sinisa Mihajlovic, the Torino coach, had sleepless nights after being offered a deal to coach in China that, in his words, was 5-6 times what he would earn in a year in Italy.
Yeah, which is fair enough. I mean, if someone wants to offer you that money, then of course it would be stupid to just turn those things down. I don't think a lot of people are denying that must be a difficult decision for you know, anyone, especially a footballer who realises they've got a very short career. I think it was that there was a quick trigger there, and I also think that China stepped in because, you know, China also want to be associated with those big names. They want, or someone in Chinese football will want to be associated with those big names, and that they can pull those big names. So it's a great PR opportunity for someone else who's looking to, you know, make a better name for that league. Although, as we heard this weekend on our bonus pod about China, China don't necessarily care what the West think. And so they'll bid whatever they want.
Yes.
Or would have, until maybe some other rules come in.
That is definitely a podcast worth checking out. Actually, I had a listen to it today while I walked the dog, and it's a fantastic, not a euphemism.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic... It's a fantastic listen, a fantastic insight onto a situation I don't think we know a great deal about at this point, do we? It's lots of snapshots about financial figures where there's not much cultural context that our guest wonderfully portrays for us.
I've got to admit, I did find it a little bit of a strange one. Because obviously it was with Simon Price, who's living in the area somewhere. I can't remember exactly where he is. I think he travels around a fair bit. And he wrote a great article for these Football Times, and he's written some great stuff on it. But you can... And it reminded me a little bit of the state of MLS at times, or the state of America. And that every time And I'm not saying Simon's deluded in any way, but it was an interesting interview, and that every time that I posed a question which was maybe slightly taking away from what has happened in China, there was an ever so slightly defensive reply, or a reply which was maybe, are you having a slight on our league? And it's actually, well, no, I'm actually asking a question because I genuinely don't know. And I think that's the thing with China, is that actually there's a lot that we don't know about that, as China as a culture, how they approach business, all those sort of things. But also I feel like it when people sort of say, well, you know, we need to... you know, we need to be mindful of how we treat other cultures in the world, those sorts of things. I don't think China are very
respectful of other people, considerate, respectful of other people's cultures. And I think there is also that opinion that, you know, if money buys whatever, then use it. And, you know, to some extent, I see their point. They are kind of, they're buying their way in. I understand that. And they are revealing also the hypocrisy of the Western world, that they believe in some way that, you know, money can't buy you success. And maybe China are just sort of proving that actually you can buy some people's affection.
You can buy success. He plays for Watford.
Very good. Although moving, maybe not right now. I thought he was injured, but yeah, fair enough.
Yes, moving around the world for a minute. Chepagoense, a story that I think touched all of us in the football community just because of the sheer sadness of the whole thing, are slowly getting themselves back on their feet. I believe they played a friendly this weekend and managed to score their first goal. Their squad, as you can imagine, is made up almost exclusively of loan players at this point. I think there's not much to say about this other than it you know, we hope this is the first of many successful steps for them.
Yeah, that and the fact that a lot terrible thing happened. Silver lining in that, this is almost a completely separate situation now, is that a lot of other people have tried to help the situation in some way. That's the frustration.
It's a nice thing to see that so much unity can be shown by Brazilian football during what is a difficult time. Moving to France and Ligue 1, we talked about Memphis there, moving to Lyon. Monaco, 64 goals in 21 games after a 4-0 win against...
How does that happen, Chris?
Lorient.
Is that just in Ligue 1 or is that in...
That's just in Ligue 1. Just in the league. They're just a fantastically exciting side to watch. You've got Lamar, you've got Mbappe, Germain, Silva as well, Falcao. They're just a side that I think is very keen to attack and is not afraid to attack. That's the other thing, is that it's all well and good pushing bodies forward, but if you're confident with it, it's a totally different proposition. And I think that's what you're seeing with Monaco. I mean, you have to remember, they scored 57 last year in the league after 38 games. Here they are after 21 with 64. So the sky is very much the limit for them. And honestly, it could bode for a really interesting Champions League tie with them next month, because, you know, underestimate them at your peril. We saw Arsenal do that long before they were scoring this many goals. Was it 2014, 2015 when they had Kondogbia in the middle and he had that really great performance at the Emirates? So yeah, this is a fantastic performance there. I believe they're still top of the league now. Lyon, as we are recording, have just beaten Marseille 3-1. Memphis did come on for a brief cameo, and he looked good from what I was able to catch. He seemed a lot more confident. The team seemed a little bit of a better fit, but of course this is a very, very small sample size. Someone that didn't get a warm reception at the weekend, Lawrence, was Ronaldo. He was booed by Real Madrid fans.
Despite obviously a positive result for Real Madrid. Bit of a weird one, really. You know, I mean,
is this the politics of a football club laid bare again?
I partly agree. I also think that it's that they see themselves as swans in that sense, and they always have at Real Madrid. You know, you're supposed to struggle under the water, and if the fans want to complain about that, then they will complain about that. And so the frustration comes when they obviously, they're not necessarily looking like swans. Zidane's come out to defend his man, and he's right to do so. Ronaldo does need that defence sometimes, I think, because, you know, he obviously is always in the spotlight. But I also, I mean, it's hard to criticise a Real Madrid side who lost 2 and then have righted it and still stayed top of the league and still, I think, are one game ahead of everyone else. One game behind. So essentially they've got one game in hand of everyone else, and are well ahead of the nearest realistic challengers, which are Barcelona, who are
I think they're 5 points behind Real Madrid now. Sevilla in second, obviously, just 1 point behind. But I think a lot of people are assuming they'll drop away or something will happen there. Maybe even the head-to-head sort of affecting them in some way.
A crack does seem like a chasm at Real Madrid, doesn't it? That's the problem, is that at a club where maybe it was less of an issue, it doesn't seem as the case with Real Madrid because of how just passionate everything is. I always remember as a kid being so confused by the waving of the sort of tissues or what have you. I think it was tissues anyway. That always confused me. It was just, yeah, it's a very confusing club I find Real Madrid. It's one that I'm constantly trying to understand and,
I think the presidency
and not always
succeeding. It's very confusing, isn't it? The presidency situation is always a confusing one.
Yes, that is true. That's something that I think maybe doesn't translate so well to an English eye, because we just don't really have those situations. Although I tell you, on a slight digression, the story of Figo moving from Real Madrid to Barcelona, our friends at UMaxit just did a sort of representation of the story. I had no idea how that all came about.
Go ahead. How did it all come about?
So essentially, Florentino Perez reached an agreement with Figo and his people to say that if he was elected president, Figo would join Barcelona, join Real Madrid, excuse me. And at the time, the chances of Perez winning were minimal at best. So Figo would be paid £1.9 million for signing the deal. If he didn't go through with the transfer, they would have to pay Florentino £19 million. So it was, again, it was that kind of, you know, if I can sink this shot from halfway, then, you know, I'll give you you have to give me 50 quid. It was, the odds were firmly stacked in Figo's favour. Perez only goes and wins the election. And so Figo has to contractually join Real Madrid, or they have to find the money. And Barcelona obviously refused to do that, and Figo had no means to pay it himself. So he ends up having to go and join Real Madrid, having denied that the contract existed in the first place as well, completely denied existence and tried to refute all claims. So it's a mad story. I just couldn't imagine that happening here.
Although
I genuinely couldn't.
You sort of imagine how that sort of deal comes about in the first place anyway, or why that deal comes about in the first place anyway.
I feel like there was a lot of alcohol involved.
Yeah.
That much, I'm sure. That, again, it's clearly, you have to think his advisor takes the rap for this one, for thinking it was a good idea and for even taking that risk and not saying to Barcelona, hey, look, we've got this offer here. Because it was only, like I say, it was only, I think, 1.9 million euros or pounds or whatever it was, which is not a vast sum, even back then. Even in the, it was probably a year and a half salary or something like that. But why would you take that risk? Anyway, I am digressing. I think that takes us neatly, though, to the conclusion of this.
Yeah, why not?
I think that's a lovely point to end. Don't chase money. You know, be true.
Chase dreams. Although, I mean, arguably he ended up as a legend at both clubs.
He did. And just imagine what might have happened if he'd never signed that deal. We would never have had maybe the Galacticos in the same way that we know them as now.
God, imagine that. Maybe we would not. Maybe Ronaldo would be our Barcelona player.
Yeah, crikey. Well, Beckham had a similar situation, didn't he, where he could have joined Barcelona. He had an offer, I believe, if memory serves. Anyway, digressing.
Imagine what would have, yeah.
Like two old men.
Imagine what could have happened in our lives.
You're very good accent. It always impresses me.
Yeah.
That concludes this episode of the Front Three podcast. Lawrence, if our friends want to find your wonderful series on /football, Journey Around Europe, the podcast that you do with him as well, any of your wonderful workings, where can they go and do that?
Got some great guests this week. I can't actually say who, but we do have some really good guests, big ones, ones who are from other places, and then the same place as us. You can just head over to The Front Three on YouTube and check out our work on there. Lots of lovely stuff. We'll be doing the vlog there, and then also head over to /football. You can also head over to our Twitter, at The Front Three. It's well worth a look. And Kristen is doing a good job of populating it at the moment. So, looks good, Chris.
Thank you very much. And obviously he's not here, but I will still plug him regardless. Statman Dave, at Statman Dave, all one word. the artist formerly known as At Squawker Dave, now freelance, bless him, in the big wide world.
Great guy.
Yes, he has his own channel as well that you can check out all of his tactical musings and such like, which I would definitely suggest, because I think it's something where you always come away learning something, which is the highest compliment I can pay, Dave, true, is that you always come away wiser for watching a video of his. But that will do us for this week. Let us know what you think, sending questions, all that kind of stuff. Keep engaging with us, because that's the best part of doing this, if I'm really honest.
Stay engaged.
And have a wonderful.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The full weekend and week.
Bye.